Well, that did the trick. Everybody quieted down, so. Welcome to November's Theology on Tap. I know you can't see me, but you can hear my voice, so that's all right. Tonight, we have a very special guest from down the road who is going to be talking about man's quest for knowledge. Right? So Socrates said that the beginning of knowledge is the minute you know nothing. So with that in mind, I'm going to hand over the mic.
Very good.
Thanks, Jenny. Jenny and I taught Totus Tuus together on a team in 1996, so a long time ago.
That's good.
So I am Father Jim Weldon. I'm from St. Joseph in Andale, which is just a little bit west of here, if you've ever heard of that. It's a great town. It has a high school. It has a swimming pool. The church is twice as big as the church here in this town. So very happy to be from St. Joseph in Andale. So tonight, I wanted to speak to you. So tonight I wanted to talk to you about the James Webb Telescope. So I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but the James Webb Telescope is a telescope that was launched into space, and it was launched on Christmas Day 2021, and then by the time it got to its location, its orbit, was the summer, July of 2022. So it took 7 months from its launch until it was activated and being used. And it was in development for over 20 years. So James Webb, the name of it, he was the guy in charge of NASA during the 1960s, during the Gemini and the Apollo programs. So James Webb, so they named it in honor of him and all the work that he did with NASA. And then also the James Webb Telescope is so complex. It took cooperation of several countries, and it was built in the United States, but scientists from all around the world worked together to make it. And then it was transferred, it was moved down to French Guiana on the north coast of South Africa, so north of Brazil, French Guiana, and that's where it was launched from. It was launched from a pad there in Guyana. So the James Webb Telescope is much more powerful than the Hubble telescope. So the Hubble telescope was launched back in the early 1990s. And when it was launched, it actually had a problem with one of its, with part of its mechanism. And so astronauts had to go and fix it. So that's one of the missions of the space shuttle when it was still active, was to go up and fix the Hubble telescope. But the James Webb telescope, its position in orbit is on the other side of the moon. So we're here on Earth, you got the moon going around the Earth, and it's farther out, and so it's in a halo orbit, and it rotates in a circle, and it follows the Earth and the moon as it goes around the sun. So it's blocked from the sun by both the Earth and the moon, and so it rests in a position out there, because its main goal is to see infrared light. And this infrared light is billions and billions of years old. It's trying to see farther back. So it's trying to see farther back than the Hubble telescope ever could. And so it's in this position so that it doesn't have any infrared interference from the sun or the Earth. So the moon blocks that. And then if you go online, you can look at pictures of it, and it has this big heat shield on it. So this heat shield is in seven layers. There's many layers, and on the one side, the side that faces the sun, it's over 200 degrees in temperature, the part that's being hit by the sun, and on the other side, it's at 7 Kelvin, which is like minus 200 degrees Fahrenheit. So they have to keep it very, very cold. So the goal of the whole telescope is to be extremely, extremely cold so that none of this infrared heat would interfere with what it's looking at. So, anyways, I just find this all fascinating. When they first proposed it, so right after they launched the Hubble telescope and it became active, they began work on this immediately right after that in the 1990s. So it took 20 years of development. From the 1990s, it was all ready to go in the year 2016, and then they did tests on it for 5 years. So for 5 years, they subjected it to every kind of test and to test its durability. Because once it gets out there where it is now, it's about 1 million miles to the far side of the moon, and there's no fixing it. So there's no space shuttle, there's no way to go and fix it if anything goes wrong. So it's a modern marvel of engineering that they were able to think of it, that they were able to build it and execute it and put it out there, and it had to operate perfectly. So they couldn't have any mistakes. So that's why they took so many years of testing it and launching it here in at the space stations in Florida and in Houston, doing all their tests on it. So why do I want to talk about this? Sometimes I like talking about it tonight, especially because this program is something great that has been done by NASA, by the United States. It's something great that has been done by engineers, and it required cooperation among many nations. And tomorrow, there's like an election going on. I don't know if you've heard about that, but so often, whenever we think, you know, of politics and all of that, there's this sense of negativity that everything's falling apart, that nothing works, and maybe you feel that way about the government. I don't know if you feel that way about the government, but the James Webb Telescope, to me, is this fantastic effort of human beings working together to achieve a great goal, something very difficult. And it took thousands and thousands of people. It also, when they first proposed it, they said it will cost $1 billion, but it ended up costing $10 billion. So over the years, you know, it got developed, it got bigger, it got more complex, it became more difficult. Any of you who have worked on a big program, you know, building anything, you know that there's cost overruns and things get out of hand. And it's difficult to do that. So whatever $1 billion is, I don't even know what that is. So that's when we think of a telescope being on the far side of the moon and staring back into space, and they're trying to look back like 10 billion years. So the sun is 93 million miles away from us. So it takes light 7 minutes to reach us. So those 7 minutes that were the light that we experienced from the sun, it took 7 minutes for it to get here from the sun. So the James Webb Telescope is looking at light that was a billion years old, or 10 billion years old. So it's looking at these galaxies, it's looking at how they were, because that light that we're seeing now, that's not how that galaxy is now. And then a great thing to think about with gravity, the James Webb Telescope, where it's positioned out on the other side of the moon, they calibrated the weight of it. And that spot, that the gravity of the moon and the Earth and the weight of the James Webb Telescope, that it would stay in that position with a minimal amount of energy being used. So it has solar power, it's solar powered, but it can't use very much energy at all, because they can't store all this energy on there. So they had to put it in this space where gravity would hold it in this orbit as it goes around, as it travels with the Earth around the Sun. So think of this small object being held in space, and then think of galaxies. So all the galaxies, all the stars affect all the other places, and all the galaxies affect each other as they are in space. And we're learning a lot about gravity from the James Webb Telescope and the effect of light and all of that. Anyways, I'm not smart enough to understand any of that, so I'm not going to pretend that I do. But what I want to propose to you, though...
He's not.
So, my brother, it's really frustrating for him to be quiet when I'm talking, so he really struggles with that. At the clergy conference, whenever I ask a question, everyone just gets their watch out, because they know within like 2 minutes he's going to ask a question too. So he's not allowed to talk at the clergy conference until I talk first. So that's the arrangement amongst all of us priests. So why do we have this desire to build this instrument? So we want to see. So, you know, we put contact lenses, or I put glasses on my face to see things more clearly, or you get LASIK surgery, you know, so your eyes work better. Our eyes, when we just take it for granted, I think it's amazing every day you wake up and you open your eyes and they work, and you're able to see the world. And if you've met someone who's blind and you've worked with them, it's really amazing. Several years ago, I was celebrating Mass at Our Lady of Perpetual Help in Wichita, and this is, gosh, 20 years ago. And it was the gospel for that Sunday was the man born blind, so John chapter 9. So that was the gospel. And so I have this homily in my mind about, you know, spiritual blindness, how we have to overcome that. So I walk up, you know, with the servers, and I was visiting there. So I was just substituting at this parish for this particular Mass. So I don't know anybody. I walk up with the servers, I get up, do the opening prayer, and I sit down, and it's time for the first reading, and this man comes up from the side who's blind, right? So this real blind man, he gets up out of the pew, and he's a regular there, and he's a lector, and he has a lectionary in Braille. So he's using his fingers to read the reading in Braille, and then he is announcing the reading to all the people. And I'm sitting in my chair and I'm like, oh, this really sucks. Because I'm going to talk about blindness, and the gospel is about blindness, and here's a real actual blind man, right? And it really struck me like, what, you know, you can't make a metaphor about sight. So, or it's insulting to a blind person to talk about sight as being this metaphor for some spiritual thing or just some spiritual message. So think how much you treasure your vision, that we treasure our vision, that we're able to see. And then not just that we're able to see, but we want to see farther. We want to see farther. So we, over the last, you know, Galileo invented the first telescope, and so for the last 400 years, we've been making better and better telescopes because we have a desire to know. We have a desire to learn. So in our humanity is this innate desire to understand the world around us. And in many different cultures, they've been able to do many great things. When you think of the Egyptians and how they built the pyramids, or in India and China, you know, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, they did beautiful things. They did wonderful things. But they did not make progress in their scientific advancement. They did not make progress. And this author here, this book, Stanley Yockey, he is a Benedictine priest. He died in the year 2005, but he had a PhD in physics. So he's a Benedictine priest, and he taught at the university level, and his PhD in physics. And he talked about, in the history of science, there is a presumption that the world can be understood. So why do we try to understand something? Why do we try to know it? Is because we presume that it can be understood, that it will make sense. So that is part of our Judeo-Christian understanding of the world, that God is the creator, and he created the world with order, and that the order of the world is something that we can grasp with our intelligence. So there is a plan of creation, there is a wisdom to it, and it can be understood. Whereas if you don't believe in God and you believe that everything is just chaos, that everything happens by chance, then the whole world is chaos. Nothing makes sense. We're just like atoms bumping into each other. There is nothing really, truly to be understood. So if there is no God, no creator with no plan, then the world we see it and we experience it as chaos, which really shuts down the desire of our intelligence to understand it. And so the James Webb Telescope is just one feat. So human beings are doing all sorts of wonderful things all around the world, building beautiful things, very complex, and doing this work. But they're doing it because there's the presumption that we can know and understand it. Whereas if we move away from that, and we get separated from the Creator, and we think that the world is just chaos, then our desire to know will become futile. And it doesn't make sense to try to understand. And so something that I fear, and what really makes me sad, is like when a young person does not have a desire to learn, does not have a desire to know. So in Spanish, the parents will always say, like, you know, about their children, you know, no tiene ganas, or échale ganas. So ganar is to win. So in Spanish, ganar is to win. So eche le ganas is to make for the win. So what do all of you, you know, if you have a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old or a 20-year-old, what is it that you want them to have? You want them to have desire. Like, if they have desire, they'll figure it out. But then if you meet somebody who has no desire, what are you going to do? How do you even motivate them? So eche leganes, I think about this desire of our human heart, our desire of our mind to know and understand the truth. So if you, this Father Stanley Yockey, this is one of his medium-sized books. He has thicker books that are harder to understand, but he's really great because he has a lot of really smaller ones, like pamphlets, like 10 or 12 pages, and he gets into all of the different scientists throughout time, especially over the last 500 years, and how they were able to move from what they knew into the place that they didn't know. So all of us, you know, there's these frontiers of knowledge that we're trying to move into. And so what does a telescope do? A telescope is an instrument, it's an eye that allows you to see into a place of darkness. Allows you to see into a cloud, to penetrate and to know that which you don't know now. And so that is one of the most fantastic things about being a human being, is that we've been given this desire, both in our minds and in our hearts, to look and to see and to understand. That's all I have. All right. So the James Webb Telescope, I don't have any cool videos or pictures. There's great stuff on YouTube, and you can go and learn about it. If you're a teacher, you can show it to your kids in school. It's really fantastic, and it's showing the universe with much greater clarity. But it's also opening up lots of questions and changing a lot of how astronomers have understood the universe over the last 100 years. So with more knowledge comes ever greater mysteries, and then a desire of our heart to understand those mysteries as well. So, thanks. I invited my brother because he said that you were all a little dull, and that so that he could help provoke the conversation by asking a question, okay? That's what he said.
I said, do you want me to be there? And then you said.
Oh, here, one thing. I was at somebody's house. This was 2 or 3 weeks ago, and somehow, you know, we're talking about farming, or I wasn't talking about farming, they were talking about farming. And I asked him, like, if you have 50 acres of corn, like, can you know how many seeds there are? And then, so he, this guy and his son, his grown adult son, they're like, well, let's figure that out, you know? So he was figuring it out, you know, and with your combines now, it's like, they want to know exactly where every single seed is, and they don't want any seed to go to waste. And it was fascinating to me, like, they were getting pretty close to actually how many seeds of corn that they were actually putting into the earth, you know, in a particular section of land. And it was fascinating to, like, think of, like, how your parents did, or how you did this 20 years ago, or 40 years ago, or 80 years ago, what a farmer did when they put seed into the ground. You know, how specific would they be? So, anyways, to me, that's an advancement of knowledge. You know, like, they're knowing exactly where they're putting it, and then they measure. The computer keeps track of what the fruit of that particular spot of ground was, and how much fertilizer you put into it, and how many whatever you put into the ground there. So, all of this science is helping farmers to be better farmers. It's helping us to be better astronomers. It's helping us in all of these different ways.
Yockey and the desire, and an incredible intellect it was, right?
Right.
And his desire, and speaking of that, how does he connect that with the fundamental Christian message?
So, that's good. So, Stanley Yockey, what he said is that we as Christians, we believe that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, that Jesus is the Word of God. And so, when the Word of God became flesh, he revealed. And so the Word has to do with knowledge. And that fundamentally, that God reveals the natural law to us through His Son, Jesus Christ. And so the whole universe is imbued with the very Word of God. So Muslims, in contrast, Muslims do not believe in the incarnation, and Muslims, to hold the transcendence of God, that God is completely separate from us, they say that God is creating the world at every moment. So at each moment, God creates the world, so you can never penetrate and know the world. So this is why the scientific effort has never really taken root or grown in the Muslim world, because they have a fundamental doubt, and they would see it as an idolatry to say that you understand the world. So anyone who says they understand the world is somehow getting into the mind of God. And so for them, the transcendence of God and the separation of God from us keeps them from understanding the world. Whereas in the Judeo-Christian ethic, the fact that there is a natural law that we are able to know and understand, and that is the revelation of who God is, that we're able to enter into that. And so we as Christians, because God, he revealed himself to us, we can move into the knowledge of God. Whereas in the Muslim world, that separation, that incarnation or that connection between God and humanity is never there. And so God is always separate.
Hey, Father, you talk about why the Vatican has one of the most powerful telescopes, and wasn't there a Catholic priest that came up with the Big Bang Theory?
So there's a Vatican observatory in Arizona, I think, and it's staffed by astronomers, and some of those astronomers are priests. So we parish priests, we're kind of like grunts, all right? So we're like jacks of all trade, and I know like a little bit about 10 million things. But then there's other priests who are smart, all right? So who are very intelligent, who get advanced degrees and like go work and teach in colleges and work in, and you know, go be astronomers or something like that. So they don't even talk to us. Like, it's funny, you go to some conference, you know, where there's like these smart priests, they won't even talk to diocesan priests at all, right? So they stay over at their own table. Anyways, so I forget what that priest's name was. There was a priest who was an astronomer in the 1910 or 1920?
No,
30. Way before that?
No, like 20s and 30s, he had explained this theory to...
Yeah, look it up on your phone. See, nobody knows anything now. So isn't that great? Like, we have our phones, and now we don't know anything.
Right.
Is it a
I can't remember.
George is mature.
Oh.
Yeah.
I don't know how to say
George?
His last name, but that's sounds
good. Lanier.
Oh, okay. All right. I was just saying it wrong.
So the church has always been interested in this work of scientific knowledge. So we should never, that's another thing, is that we should never say like that somehow faith is opposed to reason, or that somehow because we have faith, we're not interested in a scientific work. So because we have faith, we presume that the world makes sense, that there is a natural law, and that God gave us our intelligence in order to know it. So faith doesn't do away with the natural work of our intelligence, but rather faith is this motivating thing. It's this movement into the mystery. And so how do we move into the mystery is with the use of our intelligence to penetrate further and further into it. So there's lots of different scientists, and that's what Stanley Yockey, he does a lot of the history of scientific development. And then a lot of Christian and specifically Catholic scientists were very instrumental in a lot of those developments.
So how do these priests that are the scientific,
right,
that are going through all this, how do they separate the Bible, Adam and Eve,
right?
I mean, through the scientific saying we came from apes. I mean, you know what I'm saying.
So the whole question of evolution.
How do they separate that?
Well, so that gets more complex. So that's another whole talk, is to talk about evolution in Genesis, if you want to do that. Very briefly, I would say that in Scripture, Genesis chapter 1 is the first story of creation. You have the 6 days of creation, and then God rests on the seventh day. And then, in the 6 days of creation, Adam and Eve are created on the sixth day. In chapter 2 is the second story of creation. In the second story of creation, God creates the man first, then he brings them all the animals, and then he creates the woman, and then the two are together at the end. So in the Bible itself, you have two stories of creation, and they both can't be like literally true. Like they're explaining a truth about our human nature, but they're not explaining a scientific knowledge about like how our bodies came about. So the scripture is true in everything that God intends it to teach. So we can go further. That is a whole other talk. We should have a whole separate talk. All right. So.
Just
so
for a clarification, you can see on the puzzle thing and creation in their perspective.
Right.
Is continuing to be kind of thing. I mean, I've heard theologians who've also said that as an explanation for miracles, entering into where we are now and continuing this creation. Can you reconcile that, or is that...
So, again, there's another tension there of God creates the world, and he creates it according to his plan, according to the natural law, and then is a miracle somehow an interruption of that, or God interfering in some like defect in his natural law? So
yeah, they say no, it's actually continuing. It's part of the theology that God's left the contract.
Correct. So God creates and God sustains the universe. And he sustains it in his natural law. The natural law is what sustains the universe. And then a miracle is like a special intervention at a specific point in time. That's interesting. I have to think about that.
I think just to kind of build off that, we don't think that God created the universe and then just said, set it, forget it, right?
Right.
He has an active core part
right.
in creation as it goes on, whereas that is like fundamentally different from what it sounds like Muslims.
So the Muslims, their goal is to preserve the transcendence of God, that God is completely separate from us, and so that you can't understand the natural law, so that you cannot... If you claim to understand the natural law, that means you're claiming to understand the mind of God. And so they, in order to preserve that separation, it keeps them from making progress in the scientific endeavor.
Is it similar to how the Orthodox Church operates?
I wouldn't want to say that. Yeah.
Arbitrariness of God's will in the Muslim theory, as opposed to the rationalism and faith coming together, that would be that.
Yeah, I think we have to be done. Okay. So, I just encourage you, learn more about the James Webb Telescope. It's a wonderful human endeavor of human beings working together. And then the other, one little thing too, I was listening to this interview of Neil Armstrong, and he was talking about, you know, landing on the moon, and Neil Armstrong is the most famous one because he's the guy that got to walk on the moon. And Neil Armstrong says, yeah, it was 400,000 people put me here. So all the different people who worked on all the different aspects, and super smart people and very strong-willed people, and they had to be willing to fight with each other. So think of like the Apollo moon landing, all the super smart people, all those engineers, all like alpha people, like fighting with each other for this goal, right? And then the James Webb Telescope too, I'm sure they had some fights with each other. So think of those committee meetings, and think of those board meetings, and what is the right way to do this? And everyone in the room is like got a perfect score on their ACT when they were 17, you know, and like they're all, you know, they're fighting with each other about what is the right way to do it. So I think we need to be willing to fight with each other, all right? Sometimes we like let's keep it nice, you know, like we don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. But if you really have a great goal, it should be worth fighting about. So don't be afraid. So my brother and I, we are not afraid to have a fight with each other, you know, because we want to achieve something good. So if you're certain about where you're going, you can fight about how to get there, because you both want to get there. Now, I'm not married, so I'm not going to give you any marital advice on fighting, but just in general,
I read a book about it,
so yeah, in general, if we really want to achieve something great, it should be worth like arguing about. It should be worth arguing about, and not to be afraid of the argument, because you know we love the goal and we love each other, and so we have an argument about how to get there.
Yeah.
and it's okay. It's okay. All right, that's my last sentence.
All right.